Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 3.3 million students will graduate from American high schools this year. It's the largest class since 1977. And it's faced a college admissions super trial. Record application rates and competition, a lending crisis, giant college costs, and new admissions policies shaping new opportunities and challenges. This year, this hour, On Point, a super tough college admissions season and what it means and where the trends point for the next wave of graduating high school seniors. Joining me first today from Boston is Stacy Teicher-Kadaru. She covers education for the Christian Science Monitor. Stacy, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
They're calling it the perfect storm when it comes to college admissions this year, but then people call everything the perfect storm these days. What are the elements of this particular, the dynamic of getting in, applying, and getting in this year that made it so unique, maybe so difficult?
Right. Well, definitely difficult for the students who are aspiring to the most competitive colleges. Harvard admitted just 7 out of every 100 applicants, Yale just 8 out of every 100, and both were record levels of selectivity. So across the board, as you mentioned, a lot of it is sheer demographics. It's the largest class since 1977, and some people call it the echo boom.
That is the children of the boomers echoing very loudly right there.
Right. So there's the numbers, but then the other elements that you mentioned briefly, there have been things leading up to more uncertainty for students and schools for a number of years, and what's new this year is that some Ivies stopped doing early admission in the fall, so there is a whole set of students who might have made a decision earlier who were added to the pot in the spring.
So
it's a little unpredictable there.
Right.
Then there's just been a ratcheting up in recent years in this, I like this metaphor of a dance or a courtship ritual of there's so many choices, there's so many applications going out that the schools are doing everything they can to make sure they get a good yield or the rate of students who they accept actually saying yes. So they're really trying to make sure that the students they admit really want to be there rather than just they're one of 20 schools that they've applied to. And the dance of trying to figure that out on both sides has gotten more and more uncertain.
The students get judged by an acceptance or rejection letter, but colleges get judged, too, on those ranking lists by the percentage that accept their offer if they give it the yield. So everybody's got some skin in this game, you say.
Right, right. And it's not just the rankings that they're concerned about, but they're doing everything they can to set up a well-rounded freshman class for the fall. And they know that if students have 20 applications out there, which is maybe an extreme, but something I did hear from a college counselor, then they know that the chance of a student wanting to go somewhere else instead of to their school is high. So they're definitely one tool they're using is increased waiting lists.
Now, is that related? We've heard that the waiting lists have been bulging roles this year. Why are waiting lists? Why have they been so big? Why is so many students put on them?
Well, it's a tool the colleges will use so that once the students send in a yes or a no when they've been made an offer, then the school can then go, and if they have extra places, if they didn't get enough yeses from the students, the school can go to the wait list and pick and choose people to try to make that well-rounded freshman class. And for some, it's going to stretch into the summer, because even if students have sent in their deposits May 1st, they won't necessarily go to that school. If they get their dream school calling them off a wait list a month or two down the road, they might jump ship. So that's what they're dealing with the waiting list.
Stacy, one of the problems or the issues you're pointing to here is that students are applying to so many schools. You know, years back they might have applied to 3 or a half dozen, now many 10 or 20. What's the dynamic that's leading high school seniors to apply to 10 or 20 schools? Why so many on their list? It's not cheap. It's not that easy.
Right. Well, I've heard a couple factors. There's more online applications, which may make it easier for more applications to go out. There's more common applications. But it's in this very competitive realm, it really comes down to, you know, they know the statistics. They know they're the echo boom. And they feel that if they really want to get into a top school, they want to maximize their chances by sending out more applications. So one thing that college counselors really want people to understand is that on average, schools really aren't that competitive. This is a very top brand name thing, and counselors want students to realize that actually 7 out of 10 college applications get accepted. So you don't have to stress out. You can find a college that will be a good fit. It may not be one of these Ivy Leagues that only accepts 7 out of 100. But at the end, you know, everyone can go to the dance and have a good time.
So is it a tempest in a teapot then? I mean, it's a tiny portion of Americans who go to Ivy League schools or maybe even think about it. If that's where all the tension is, for most kids, is it pretty much smooth sailing?
Well, it's hard for me to judge for most kids. Maybe some of your other guests can give you a better feel for that. But I certainly talked to counselors who worked with a range of kids. And, you know, they said that not everyone gets caught up in this super competitive thing. Some are perfectly happy to go to their local state college if they don't get into their top dream school. But there are parents out there and there are students out there who are just bound and determined. They have their mindset on a particular school. And I talked to one kid who was, you know, making a full court press to go to Duke University because he was such a big fan of the Blue Devils. You know, he had gotten accepted at a number of other strong schools, but he's trying to get himself off that waiting list.
And Stacy, what about the money angle here? I'm looking at a list of most expensive colleges, tuition, room, and board, and it's just getting, I mean, we thought it was over the moon, you know, 2 seconds ago. Now here's George Washington, $51,110 for tuition, room, and board. Johns Hopkins, 47 plus. Brown, 47 plus. Boston College, 46 plus. Cornell,
right.
45 plus. I mean, and right on. What's driving that? And what are the special financial circumstances students and their families are looking at this year?
Right. Well, in terms of financial aid this year, one of the new things on the landscape is that a number of top schools have gotten a lot of press this year for changing their financial aid policies and saying, if your family makes under a certain amount, sometimes it's $200,000, $150,000, around there. If you're sort of in the lower or middle income level, you can come to our school and graduate debt-free because we will make up the difference with grants.
Harvard did that. Anybody else? It takes a huge endowment to be able to offer that.
Right. I'm not sure. Maybe Duke, Tufts, a number of Amherst, a number of schools have done that.
Their versions.
Mm-hmm. But because it's the first year that it's become such a big policy at a number of schools, it's made the admission scene even more unpredictable because the schools that don't have the endowments to do that are wondering, okay, what effect is that going to have on the competition between schools for these top students?
But it's a tiny number who are going to get that debt-free ride. And meanwhile, with the subprime lending crisis and all the rest, we read about student lending institutions sort of drying up and blowing away. What's the availability of credit for students this year?
Right. Well, there was some news last week that actually should provide a lot of reassurance to people that they can get the aid they need for the fall. The federal loan system is being shored up by an act of Congress that just sort of kicked into gear some elements that had already been in place if there is a crisis in the loan industry. And people haven't agreed that it's an all-out crisis by any means yet, but they're preparing to make sure there's a steady flow of capital into the student loan market. So people should be reassured at this point that they can get the loans that they need for college. And, in fact, Congress increased the amount of federal loans, which are at a good interest rate, that families can access. So they should look there first, and they should talk to financial aid officers at the schools that they're considering.
Stacy, does this go right on? I've read that the peak we still haven't reached. It may be next year that the echo boom, the children of the boomers, reach their absolute height. So whatever frenzy there's been this year, it's not over yet?
That's possible. I talked to a counselor who said that's the most frequent question that she gets, and she doesn't know the answer yet. I don't think anyone knows for sure. We don't have a crystal ball to know exactly what's going to happen with the demographic trends, but it is possible that the trends we're seeing this year will continue another year.
You've talked with a lot of families in the midst of this. Are people losing their cool or you know, managing to sort of stay level-headed despite the competition?
Yeah, I think people can take it in stride. I mean, they might get caught up in the moment of feeling like, oh, why me? And why do I have to be at the height of this this peak of students applying to colleges? But in the end, the American university system really does have a lot to offer to people, and I think they can find a good fit and move on from, you know, the stress and the strain and just go on to enjoy their college experience.
And finally, for those who are still on a waiting list for some place that they'd like to go, describe that. You use the word dance to us, but that, you know, how do colleges decide out of everybody on their waiting lists who to tap? How do they suss out who's most likely to come?
Right. Well, one way they suss it out is simply to ask students, do you want to stay on our waiting list? And sometimes in the case of Carnegie Mellon, for instance, they have a priority waiting list, and they say, you can choose to be on this priority waiting list, and we'll call you first if we get a place open. But if you're on that list, you have to be ready to commit within 24 hours by sending in a deposit. So they're looking for the people who really know it's their top choice, and they'll be able to make a decision right away if they get an offer, say, this week or next week, now that Carnegie Mellon is getting their answers from their first round of admits.
Wow.
So there are different sort of tiers of waiting lists, and then I've heard that what they do is go and look for, you know, they may have certain elements in their class for musical instruments or sports that, you know, if they didn't get enough acceptances from people in that category, they may look on the wait list for someone who fills that niche.
Fancy footwork right down to the end of the game. Stacey Teicher-Kideru with the Christian Science Monitor, thanks for your reporting and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll talk with enrollment officers and guidance counselors about this super tough year for college admissions. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a super tough year for college admissions and where the trends point for the next wave of graduating high school seniors. You can join the conversation. Were you in the college application game this year? What did you see out there? Tell us your story. Did your son, your daughter get the colleges of their choice? Get in? Are they still waiting to learn? And what about the money? Did you aim for the best school or the best deal? How does it feel to be applying to college in the crush of the echo boom? I'm joined now from Houston, Texas, by Chris Munoz. He's vice president for enrollment at Rice University, very selective school there in Houston. He oversees both the admissions office and the financial aid office. Before coming to Rice, he worked as the chief admissions officer for Case Western Reserve, the University of Dayton, and California Lutheran University. Chris Munoz, thanks very, very much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So you're a tough school to get into. Do you see what everybody seems to be talking about, this tough, tough year for applicants out there?
Yes. We certainly have experienced that here at Rice. And in fact, this year we actually had approximately 1,000 more students who applied. But yet the total number of students that we admitted was essentially was the same as last year. So definitely our selectivity, that is the number of students that we admitted, is down a little bit, if you will, or fewer students were admitted as a result.
How do you – I mean, we've heard the complaints and the cries of woe and sometimes the cheers from the applicant side. You're sitting on the admissions and enrollment side. How do you look at this dynamic? Stacey and others have called it the perfect storm. How do you look at the dynamic of what's going on there from inside the tower?
Well, from inside the tower, there is obviously some joy in the fact that this year for Rice University we are not are going to the wait list. We're not going to be admitting students off the wait list. At least that's what it.
And you're happy about that. That means you don't need to. You got a hands up yes from a good yield of your applicants already. Is that it?
Correct. In fact, one of the unexpected surprises is that our actual number of students who deposited of those we admitted is up as well. So we had a goal to enroll an entering class around 775, and right now it looks as though we're going to be probably somewhere between 790 to 810.
So, I mean, is this just the way
schools like it. A huge mob outside their gates fighting, you know, tooth and nail to get in, and weeping and wailing and cheers, and you couldn't be happier?
Well, there's another side of the story here, and that is I'm ultimately the person who gets that phone call, gets that letter, gets that email of those students and parents who were very persistent in wanting to have their son or daughter to attend Rice University. And that is a challenging moment because it's very difficult to explain to a parent, despite the fact that their son may have a perfect SAT and has a 4.0 GPA, but we elected to put them on a wait list. And that is a very challenging moment for us. So there's another side of the story.
Now, Harvard and a few other Ivy League schools this year have made some pretty dramatic moves on the cost of college, sort of to make it affordable for middle class, I guess you'd say, applicants. In Harvard's case, up to a family income of $180,000, pretty healthy, but nevertheless, they're essentially guaranteeing you'll come out of Harvard debt-free. We'll make that possible. What does that mean for a school like Rice and for others? Does it have a, I don't know if this is the right term, forgive me, but is there a trickle-down effect?
Yes, and we're not certain yet how that's going to play out. This year, for Rice University, it doesn't seem to be, but we don't know what's going to happen next year. We do have overlap in admissions with some with Harvard University and as well as some of the other top-tier Ivy League universities, but also a number of also very highly selective universities who also have elected to make some changes as a result of the decision that Harvard made. And that's what we don't know yet, precisely how that's going to affect us. Most universities, even the highly selective universities, do not have the resources that a Harvard has to make such a wonderful, wonderful offer to ensure or to aid students from family incomes that historically, you know, was a little more difficult for them to meet the costs. And Harvard definitely has done something that's very, very admirable. But on the other side of it, for the rest of us, it's going to be very difficult for us to match what Harvard has done.
Does it mean then, Mr. Munoz, that the middle class then, Cracker Jack middle class kids stampede to Harvard and other schools who can offer this, and what you then have is more affluent students at your gate because they don't need that offer?
Well, I think that it's all relative. Harvard University at an income level of $180,000, I mean, basically, and again, I admire them. They are basically saying that a student in the past who would not have been eligible for need-based aid now is going to be given some assistance. So that's that middle to upper middle income group. But in terms of Rice University, our new policy, and that is that anyone from a family income of $60,000 or less who is eligible for need-based aid will not have any loans in their what we call their financial aid package for their entire undergraduate career. That's what we can do. That's what we are doing. And in addition to that, Rice University historically has actually been anywhere from $7,000 to $8,000 below our peers in terms of the tuition level. This year, our tuition is going to be $29,000, which is on average around $6,000 to $8,000 below most of the other Ivies and other highly selective universities. But that's what we can do. We couldn't do the $180,000 that Harvard is doing.
I want to talk about changes in early admissions policies as well and what that has meant and may mean in years to come. But we've got a lot of listeners with questions and comments here. Let's go to Glastonbury, Connecticut. Jim, you're on the air with Chris Munoz from Rice University in Houston.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hello.
We just went through the madness. My daughter's a senior at a competitive suburban high school, and it was very easy to get caught up in looking at a very narrow band of selective schools.
Mm-hmm.
Just after going through the process, my daughter was rejected at several schools, got into some others, and some of the other ones turned out to be a perfect fit. I wanted to encourage parents.
Good.
Might get caught up in that to look beyond those hot schools, so to speak.
Because that their madness lies, you're suggesting, Jim.
And you do receive sticker shock if you're looking at private liberal arts colleges. There are I can't think of a one you applied to that was under $40,000 a year. Luckily, I would encourage parents to go ahead and apply and see what type of a financial aid package they get, because the schools are. He'd be fairly generous in that regard.
So. Yeah, Jim, you raise a good point and a good angle. And Chris Munoz, how about it? On the one hand, schools like yours, Rice, trade on their elite status, want to be and are hot. Here's Father Jim saying, you know, American students and families need to get off that obsession with a few elite or hot schools. It's a big country with a lot of schools. What do you say to that?
Well, I agree wholeheartedly, and I worked at the University of California and a number of other public universities, in addition to the private universities that I'm have worked with most recently. So I understand the public university in terms of what it offers, and it's very, very, very good. And I think one bit of advice, and I'm following up on this comment from the parent, is that I really believe it's so important that when parents and students begin to group colleges that they're thinking about applying to, that they should look at one or two universities that they feel that there's a high level of confidence they're going to be admitted to. They should, investigate them just with the same energy that they would for a very highly selective university like Rice University. So that when they go through the process, and if it doesn't turn out well for them in terms of their reach schools or the universities they prefer to attend, they know that there's another university that's really good for them and that they're going to be successful by attending that university. And I think that goes a long way to lower the temperature of the pressure of getting into the most highly selective universities.
Of course, and we'll ask about this, but we read about schools that some may have at one time considered safety schools now becoming stretch schools themselves. Chris Munoz in Houston, please stand by for a moment at Rice University, head of enrollment there. I want to hear from a couple of guidance counselors who have been kind of in the trenches with students, high school seniors, applying this year. Joining us first from Weston, Connecticut, is Nancy St. Clair. She's director of guidance at Western High School. She's been at it for about 7 years. Nancy, thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
Good to have you. And with us from Skokie, Illinois, is Donna Verklin, college counselor at Niles North High School. She's been a college counselor there for about 15 years. Donna, thank you for being with us.
Well, hi, Tom.
It's great to have you. Donna, first to you. Give us a sense of your school and sort of the profile of the school and the biggest targets for your students there. What's it look like from Niles North?
Well, our school is a public four-year comprehensive high school, and we have about 2,300 students. We have a very diverse community. We have a large ESL population, English as a second language. We have students from Korea, Assyria, China. We have China.
41 languages spoken at Niles North, I read.
Correct, yeah. So we have the gamut, the whole gamut. We have the high income, we have the low income families. So I'm very blessed that I can work with all different types of in different areas.
And are your students elite school obsessed, or does that seem like a distant phenomenon to you? Or are they looking closer to home?
Well, many of our students look close to home, and we do have some students who are on the elite side, but they come down to, they're looking at all the statistics. They're doing their homework.
On the elite side, I'm reading here you've got one young graduate, a young woman looking at Stanford, but also a candidate for a full scholarship at Indiana University. So she's right on that, financial pivot point this year. How's she weighing that decision?
Well, she also has gotten the Danforth scholarship at Washington University also. So she decided that she's going to go to Stanford. Stanford really gave her a great financial aid package. In fact, her parents were just shocked for about a week because
they'll be the envy of everybody who hears their story.
Excuse me?
They will be the envy of everyone who hears their story, huh?
Yeah, her parents were very shocked, and she is very pleased. So she, you know, has withdrawn from her other two schools so that someone else can get in there and get the packages from Indiana and also from WashU.
But there you are in a kind of middle of the country school with maybe a kind of middle of the country view of the college applications season. From that perspective, does this one look so different to you, or pretty familiar, Donna?
Well, this year I'm seeing more waitlisting. I'm seeing more comparing of financial aid. Students were not making the decision, you know, in March and April. They were waiting to get all their financial aid packages in.
Nancy St. Clair in Western Connecticut, you've got a Northeastern school there, Northeastern population.
Yep.
Maybe a little more affluent, maybe a little more focused on that elite name brand for schools.
Yes, and you can hear our bells ringing right now probably to change classes.
That's cool.
We are a small, affluent community, and the school is very small. It would be fair to say that sometimes the tension surrounding the college process in Weston is palpable in the halls. It drives our scheduling process. Students are feeling that they need to be taking more advanced placement and honors classes, and we are working hard to help them try to find some balance in their life so that they stay healthy emotionally and physically. Also, a lot of students have their eyes on Ivies, but I've also found this year in particular that parents and students are a little bit more realistic due to the trends and some of the statistics. So I'm agreeing perfectly with Jim from Glastonbury, who said try to see beyond the Ivies, try to work with your students to find schools that are off the beaten path, for example. Weston students tend to apply to all the same schools, so we work very hard to make their list appropriate in terms of competitiveness, but then some hidden jewels, we call them, some schools.
You've described the stress level as unbelievable, emotional and physical there, and we're told that there may be even a bigger high school class graduating next year. Do you see some turn in this tide, Nancy St. Clair, or does this go on?
Certainly hoping so. We are, as I said, we sit down as a school and certainly as a department and really work on the message that we are sending. There are certain, in other words, you don't have to be in all advanced placement courses in order to find a school that is wonderful and a good match for you. We also, in this area, we're one factor. There is obviously a huge press to be tutored for your SATs, for your PSATs. A lot of families have individual educational consultants, so who could be sending a completely different message than our school. But again, I think because of the trends, I think the current juniors who I'm working with now seem more realistic. They're certainly doing their homework. They're well-researched, well-informed.
Chris Munoz, you're sitting on the other side of the wall from guidance counselors who've been hard at work out there. You hear Nancy St. Clair describing the tension as so high. Are you responsible, sir, you and your kind, for cranking it up to that level?
I guess we might be. No. Well, there are some real pending issues that have not yet been mentioned, and one is definitely the demographics. The number of high school graduates has peaked and is now about to actually go down some. And then there's another variable that it's uneven in terms of where that's going to take place. The demographics changes in the Midwest and the Northeast are going to be very sharp. So that's going to create some new kind of competitive opportunities, I guess, for highly selective universities in those locations.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a super tough year for college admissions and where the trends point for the next wave of graduating high school seniors. We've been joined from Rice University in Houston, Texas, by Chris Munoz. He's vice president for enrollment at Rice. From Weston, Connecticut, by Nancy St. Clair, director of guidance at Weston High School. And from Skokie, Illinois, by Donna Verklin. She's college counselor at the Niles North High School there in Skokie. And we've got Jody calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Jody. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In sitting here listening, I've come up with a couple other things I wanted to add to my original question. My original question was, I have a daughter graduating in 2010 from a large public high school here in Norfolk.
Great.
I'm wondering if the numbers are going up for the people who are going to be applying to college in the next couple of years. Also, she is a girl, and I keep hearing that girls, you know, there's so many more girls applying to college than boys, and I'm worried about that for her. And lastly, the original speaker, the woman at the beginning of the hour, talked about there are hidden gems, good state college. Well, we live in Virginia, and our flagship state school is impossible to get into, even in state.
University of Virginia.
Yes, it's they take a high percentage of in-state, out-of-state students, and so by doing that, it's very controversial down here. In that they don't take as many, you know, qualified in-state students as they can. My daughter has a friend who had a 4.3 and a 1,300 on her SATs, respectable in-state, and
right.
rejected.
Yeah, you raise a lot of great issues there, Jody, and let us go at them one by one, not least this issue of some state schools kind of turning their stripes toward elite school status, even though they're state schools. I guess let me go first, if I may, to you, Donna. Donna Verklin at Niles North on the issue of gender here. We've read a lot of stories about how high school girls are often seen as outperforming high school boys lately and taking up more seats in college. So is it going to be tougher for young women to get into the college of their choice than for young men?
You know, I really haven't seen that. Many of our girls and our guys are getting into places that they're applying to, and basically it's because they've been doing their homework. You know, they've been researching, but I haven't seen a trend where, you know, girls have gotten denied at all.
Chris Munoz, how about from the university side of this, looking over the gates? You know, there has been a lot written about young women performing at a higher level than men, and so what about it? Are you having to make allowances to have a gender balance?
No, we're very fortunate. Our gender balance essentially is 50-50, so we're not faced with that challenge. I am aware that some of the liberal arts colleges, however, do face that, and I'm not certain as to what they do to try to mitigate that, where there are about 60 to 65% of students in those schools that are female.
Nancy St. Clair, Weston, Connecticut, tougher for girls?
I don't see. I'm not experiencing that either. I think we're fairly balanced between males and females in terms of acceptances.
And Nancy, what about this issue of state schools who are sort of shouldering, sometimes quite successfully, into this elite school game? Jody's got UVA, University of Virginia, which is very high standing. We read about others who are increasingly turning beyond public funds to private funds as well and presenting themselves as sort of prime targets for top students nationwide. Do you see that trend, Nancy?
Yes, I certainly do in Connecticut. And University of Connecticut, when I first started, was considered a lot less competitive than it is now. Our top students are applying there. The public colleges are highly competitive now.
And Donna Verklin, do you see that going on? Does it make it tougher for some of your students who are aiming at public colleges and universities?
Without a doubt, University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana is very selective, and now I'm seeing overflow into the other state universities, and that's making them even more selective. So yes, I definitely see that trend.
And Chris Munoz, then Jody also asks about what trends the future holds. You began to allude to that just before the break there. You've got kind of a radical thesis of where the demographics are going here. Lay it out for us.
Well, the future is actually there's going to be a smaller high school graduating class for up to the next 7 or 8 years. But what also is going on is over the last 4 or 5 years, the actual college-going rate among all high school graduates has been on a modest decline. And I believe that that's connected to the demographic shifts that are taking place in our country. And a summary statement would be is that in the future, students from lower incomes with lower levels of academic preparation are going to be replacing students who come from higher incomes with higher levels of academic preparation.
Because there are going to be fewer of that latter category?
Correct. There are going to be fewer. And there's a correlation with the fact that Caucasians are going to be declining at a higher rate than any other group.
And historically, and now, our country has not been nearly as successful in providing K-12 education for other groups, very broadly speaking.
Correct. Especially with the emerging and growing Hispanic population, which has a very poor high school graduation rate and also, unfortunately, a very low participation in higher education.
So what are the implications of that for college admissions first, Chris Munoz?
Well, I think the implications are I have a deep concern for the future. I have a deep concern that so many high school graduates are not going to continue their education, appear not to be, and what the consequences is going to be for our future in terms of our employment of highly skilled workers in the United States and those kinds of things. I'm very concerned about that. But for the highly selective universities, I believe that there will be some, change in terms of who they might admit. But they probably are going to still remain to be highly selective, maybe not quite as this year.
So, I mean, this is the kind of conversation we don't often have. But the bottom line I'm hearing in what you're saying is it make it easier for Caucasian students to get into elite schools. You're worried about other populations not going to college in the numbers that we need, what, for the economy? But I mean, in your name, Mr. Munoz, I hear some Hispanic or Latino heritage. Does it feel weird making that complaint?
It does. but as someone who comes from a Mexican American background, I have a little extra sensitivity to this issue. But I definitely think that it's something that's going to have to be addressed. I'm very concerned for our future. How many young people who are not graduating from high school that are going to be in our communities. So it's something that's personally important to me.
Fewer students in the pool coming up and a different profile maybe. Let's get a call from Salt Lake City. And John, hi, John, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah.
Excellent show. I'm in between classes here at my high school. I also have guidance counseling background, but I teach now. I want to just make a point that, high-quality community colleges can be a real godsend to people that are short of cash.
Mm-hmm.
And we personally in our own family had good luck with that with three kids, all high-achieving adults now. But our daughter took advantage of the community college route. She's the only one that got done with her baccalaureate degree in 4 years.
Good for her.
Yeah. And, the books are all in the library. That's what I tell kids. They're all online now. The elitist effort to, push towards just high-quality, high-cost colleges, I think, is something we just really need to forget. Get them going. Get them into a good community college if that's the best they can do financially, and get them started to be students. That's what it's all about.
John, that sounds like great advice, and I want to go to Donna Verklin. Donna, I think at Niles North, that is a very common path. How do you see it working out?
I see it working out quite well. We send about 20-22% to our community college, and we have an excellent community college. And most of the kids that go in the programs, go in the transfer programs, so therefore they are looking at, and they do an articulation with the college of their 4-year college of their choice.
So they end up moving from the 2-year community college onto a 4-year college, the majority of them?
As far as I know, correct, yes.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good path. Do you How do you advise them on financial terms or academic terms? You know, how do you decide how to advise a graduating senior whether to aim a 4-year or 2-year right out of the gates?
Well, when I bring families into my office, I let them, they already have some schools that they have in mind, mm-hmm. and we sit and we talk about these probable schools, which used to be called the safety schools, mm-hmm. and we talk about the maybe schools and the reach schools. So I'll have all the students look at and have some reach schools on their list. I don't just bring them in and say, this is a community college, you should go there. No, that's their decision, and if they put our community college for whatever reasons, it could be, you know, they don't want to leave home. They want to stay at home, or it could be a financial thing. And most of them, after I ask them why the community college, they will say financial reasons. So, you know, I don't start out with it, the community college, but I, you know, they put it on their list under their probable or, quote, safety schools.
They don't want to mortgage themselves necessarily straight out of the gate, and that is very understandable. John in Salt Lake, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Melrose, Massachusetts. And Ed, hi, Ed, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. How you doing?
Well, thanks. What do you know?
Well, I've navigated this archipelago of colleges, and I think the one thing that I came out with was a surprising result. My boy was accepted to Georgetown, NYU, and a bunch of other schools, BC locally here, that we couldn't afford. And they did not come up with much of a financial aid package. What we wound up finding out was he got into MIT.
Sounds like he did pretty well.
Well, yes, he's a smart kid, but the point is MIT made it possible for him to go, and the other schools did not.
Did that make his decision, your decision with him, a no-brainer then?
Yes, we're absolutely correct. It was a no-brainer. When MIT made it possible, that's where we're going. You know, but you were absolutely correct, I think, that there is a trend in the schools I mentioned that they will take someone, I think, who can afford to pay and it doesn't really quite have the same academic standard.
Let us look at that, Ed, and congratulations to you and your son on the admission and the ride he got there. Nancy St. Clair, first, just on the issue of cost. I mean, these numbers, and I'm still looking at them here in this, you know, tuition, room, and board. They're just amazing. Wesleyan, down in your neck of the woods, $46,666. Bowdoin, up in Maine, $46,260. Go right across Northwestern, $45,840. Out in Donna's neck of the woods. Do you ever, as a guidance counselor, a college counselor, feel guilty about, I don't know, recommending or steering people toward these colleges, which are going to take such a bite out of the family budget?
Well, I take the same approach as Donna does. When I'm meeting with students, they usually come, they've done their research, and their parents have done some research, and so they come in with a list. I can say that even in an affluent town such as Weston, that the cost is playing a much bigger part this year and last year also in final decision-making on which colleges to attend. You add just those basic costs that you're talking about, tuition, room, board, and if you add if you have to add airfare to it or mm-hmm. whatever else, it is playing a much, much bigger part.
Do you see expensive colleges, as Ed perceives or imagines, tilting toward affluent students who can pay the freight, never mind those few Ivy League schools who are now trying to make it, you know, middle class easier in general? Do you see that kind of tilt, Nancy?
I honestly can't say that I do. I can say that with my personal students, the colleges are making every effort, going out of their way to make some sort of, to make it manageable for students.
Chris Munoz, cross your heart and hope to die. Do you look at the numbers before you give the green light?
No. Most highly selective universities do not. They're need blind. And what that basically means is that when you make the admission decision, we do not know what is the capacity of the student and their family to meet our costs. They're admitted solely based upon their academic qualifying records and the other variables and attributes that they bring to improving the quality of the university. On the other side of it, for Rice University, as an example, we meet full need, and so we're I'm so pleased that we're in that position where whatever the need is for the student, we can meet it.
But you're defining need differently from, for example, Harvard now, who's saying, we're going to make sure you're debt-free. That's not a guarantee that you're giving to middle-class students.
What we do, which is very actually quite generous, but it certainly couldn't match Harvard, is that what we say, any student with financial need will not leave Rice University with debt more than $14,500, which is actually pretty good. So that's what we can do. And then the other, of course, is to the best of our ability to keep our overall costs down. Our tuition fees and room and board is up there, but not at the levels that you've been describing. We're slightly over $40,000.
That's a pretty good guarantee, all things considered. Donna Verklin, you've been at this 15 years. We've just got a minute left here. For all those parents and families out there listening, thinking about this year or the years ahead, what's your fundamental advice on how to position their thinking on college applications and admissions, Donna?
Well, I think they should really do their research and shop around and compare, visit colleges, talk with the people at the college, talk to the admissions counselors, talk to the financial aid advisors. They're wonderful people, and they love to take questions from students. And I really highly encourage students to make that contact and talk with them, because they are so giving and they really do care about students. That's been my finding.
Well, make that contact, but good luck at the same time. It's been full body contact this year, and it sounds like maybe another season or two before that eases up, but perhaps there's relief on the way, at least in the numbers. Donna Verklin at Niles North High School in Skokie, Illinois, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome.
Nancy St. Clair at Weston High School, Weston, Connecticut. Nancy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Keep your sense of humor about this whole thing.
Okay, we'll do it.
Bye-bye.
Chris Munoz, VP for enrollment at Rice University. Thank you very much, Chris, for joining
us. Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good luck, everybody. This is On Point.